So streaming has begun. I thought we might do this one live because why the hell not? So for those at
So
home, we're going through a heat wave. So if we sound a little warm, then that's that'll be
if you
why.
can hear the steam running up our bodies right now, that's what's
Yeah.
happening.
So there's that. But House the Dragon is back, baby. We got it. Okay.
Woo!
Kind of came out of nowhere, huh?
It kind of did. Like I
Yeah.
didn't know until you told me. I was
Remember one
working.
trailer, but I feel like that was ages ago.
Yeah, like 3 months ago. There might have been another trailer, but I saw an advert for it in the street, and that's all. Although I don't watch a lot of telly these days. But to be honest, I only found out about it because I was working on the Ars as a Theory website, and I thought, you know what? I'm gonna spring and buy the domain. So I did. So if anyone wants to check out arsisthetheory.uk, the reason it's
Wow.
.uk is because it's cheap and what else is it? Oh, it's run by Nominet, which is like a pretty decent company. So I think they're a non-profit, actually, the one that manages all our domains here in the UK. So I thought, eh, it ticks two of the boxes I need. So
Nice.
yeah, so I did. I've been working on that, and I'm quite happy with how that's turned out. Although, admittedly, if you're watching this on YouTube, it's the same stuff. You know, like it's not. There's nothing. But I don't know. If YouTube gets like swallowed up by the sun at some point, then at least it's a little like, archive, and you can download the episodes, you can take them home as a souvenir. And it gave me a little chance to work on a little coding project. I'm actually developing a podcast platform, which is quite nice. So very like minimalist, which is what I'm trying to go for. Not 'cause like I remember like work, you've done website stuff, haven't you, Max? And you're probably familiar with the bootleg that is WordPress. Yeah, there's all the PHP and the constant updating and the theme. It's just there's a lot to WordPress. It's a monster. So I thought it gets to a point where it's easier just to create your own. So that's what I did.
That's awesome. That
Yeah.
looks great too.
Nice. Yeah, it was a fun time. And also, of course, we're doing this live, which actually I haven't got any of the chat up here. So I don't expect there'll be anyone in the chat.
I mean, I've just pinged it out in my Discord. Who knows?
Oh,
It's
that's
kind
nice.
of slightly too early for a lot of the guys who usually hang out in my Twitch streams, but we'll see.
Well, there'll be the video on demand and stuff and all that kind of business. But I figured if we're going to record it, we might as well live stream it, I guess. It all works like that, really. So
Yeah.
there's that.
I realize we've missed the opportunity to call this the Hot D live stream.
Oh, actually, we haven't. I bet I can change it. I just got to find out where to change it.
Nice.
Okay, where is it? Okay, oh God, YouTube keep changing the thing.
I'm so out of sync with all of YouTube features at the moment. I realize that I've not actually posted a video for like probably nearly a year. I've neglected YouTube badly.
Do you know, right? I don't know. I haven't actually told anyone, right? Because I'm not that guy to when I stop using, well, anymore, where I stop using a social media platform, I announce it. I've privated my YouTube channel because I found that it was actually taking up a bit of a negative headspace for me, in the
Oh,
sense that,
really?
well, the thing is, it's like there are certain videos I know that I can make that I know will do well. And then after a while, you get bored of making those type of videos. And then it always kind of weighs over you. So mostly what I've been doing these days is just like focusing on my website. And I like hang around on Mastodon a little bit, and I do a little bit of live streaming on my website as well. But really, to be honest, and I do a bit of writing as well on my little website. And I think that kind of scratches the itch. Do you still live stream much, Jenny, on Twitch?
I do when I can. So it's been my sister's currently living in my flat on and off. So I don't want to stay up late at night when she might want to be asleep. That's slightly limited how much I can stream because I'm trying not to, get in the way of her kind of relaxing time. So I've been softly streaming on Tuesday nights because she usually does gaming at my parents' house that night.
Like board gaming?
So I can no, she's got a gaming computer, but if she's living kind of between houses a little bit, Okay. It makes sense for the gaming computer to be at the place with, you know.
I know we're live right now, so I don't want to I don't want to ask too many personal questions here. But I have a lot of questions. But that's fine. Okay. I can ask them all.
We'll save it for after stream.
What is this situation that involves a gaming computer over here and sleeping over here? Wow. Okay.
Well, you gotta go where you have the best ping.
You don't want to decamp an entire gaming computer.
It's a big project.
Particularly if you're living between different locations, so it makes sense for it to stay in a fixed location. And so she has that at my parents' house. That's the quick answer. But we can go into more detail off stream, but I won't get into that right now. But basically, I've not been able to stream as much because I don't want to stream if it's interrupting my sister's sleep schedule, and my gaming, my kind of office/craft room/streaming room has become her
activities
bedroom.
Room. Wow.
We got my activity the room. I haven't been streaming as much as I would like. And then on Tuesday nights, I've also been, my boss keeps putting me on late nights, so I haven't been able to stream as much as I would like. I would like to. Every time I stream, and Catnip can attest to this, every time I stream, I'm like, this is lovely, I should do this more often, I'm having such a good time. Then I schedule myself around it. But I do like streaming. That's the thing, is when I think about YouTube videos I want to produce, are basically just what I do on Twitch. It's just, you know, chatting.
Yeah.
And so what the pressure for me with YouTube is, if I'm doing it as a YouTube video, then it's basically what I would do on Twitch. But I'm making it, obviously nothing on the internet disappears, but Twitch, because of the sheer number of streams I've done and chatting and everything, it just kind of, it's words on the wind, it disappears. Someone were to trace back,
do you think that ephemerality is nice?
I really like it. I think there's a lot less pressure for me that way, because it feels conversational. And I feel like when I put something on YouTube, it's kind of like making a stamp.
Yeah,
so I feel like when I do YouTube, I feel like it's got to be something important or something that I want to look back on. While Twitch, I almost never look back on my previous streams. I mostly just delete my VODs from my my laptop after a while, because I run out of space after a while. Mm-hmm. While YouTube, I feel like, oh, that's an archive. Like, it's a chronicle. That sometimes puts a lot more, I feel like it's sometimes a lot more pressurized. Versus Twitch, where I can just kind of chill out. The other thing is, this is going to be a weird personal thing, but I feel like authors shouldn't write books if they don't read. I feel like people shouldn't aspire to become dancers if they don't go and see dance shows. I feel like the YouTube that I like to watch is not the kind of YouTube I like to create. And so I feel weird producing YouTube content that I wouldn't want to watch, or I wouldn't want to experience myself. It feels very
Yeah, I kind of feel that. Yeah.
It's a weird pressure. Mm. But yeah, anyway, so that's why I haven't been doing as much YouTube. I nearly filmed a video this week. I was going to film a video about keeping cool in the summer. It was just so rambly and so incoherent. I'm like, why would I put this to paper?
See, I agree with everything you said there, which is a lot of the reasons why I've rolled back from YouTube. I quite like podcasty stuff, because it's like a conversation. It's like a moment in time, a bit, where it's not,
it's,
you know,
you're not collaborative.
Yeah,
and that's part of the reason why I like doing this with you guys so much, is because you can't experience something for the first time twice.
Yeah.
And having the excitement and the and you know, it's one of the really nice things about week to week releases. Mm. Is you can have that hype and excitement and theorizing, and Game of Thrones as a universe is one of those ones that you kind of can have fun playing with what are they going to do with this plot? I like having that put to pen. I like having that chronicled, because it's a very specific experience that can't be duplicated.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I enjoy when you live stream, But we both do shift work, which always makes live streaming an extra yeah. level of more difficult to both watch and do. Because I like the way 100%. That I live stream, and it's similar to the way you live stream, where we've got our chaps, our friends, or, you know, like our, I don't know, what do you, it's the people that you hang out with. And
your streaming acquaintances.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because they're not like fans. We're not Taylor Swift or nothing like that. But at the same time, it is not a conventional friendship either. It's somewhere.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the something else.
It's a parasocial question mark. And it's been brought up a couple of times in the history of people experiencing the internet for the first time, and like if you're spending 4 hours with someone a week, like if they stream 4 days a week at 1 hour, or they do like two-hour streams, that could potentially be more time spent with that person than you spend with a sibling or with a parent or with your life partner, depending on your shift pattern. And so that it's a very strange parasocial situation to be in, and it is like part of the reason why once you've formed friends, and if you're into like I would consider people friends if I've had this sort of conversation where it's an active dialogue on equal footing.
Yeah,
like if we all decide to have cameras on, we're all cameras on. If we decided not to have all cameras on, then we're all in the same sphere of communication.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to streaming or YouTube, where the tier of communication is a video audio presentation of yourself versus text, it's an uneven footing. So I a lot of the time I wouldn't necessarily consider people that I interact with regularly online who I haven't had video calls with or had online streams with where we're completely equal friends. There's a few, as a company included Kenneth, who I would consider friends, but that's because we've had equal conversations.
I mean, catnip's been around for years. I mean, I know I only ever catch catnip in Jenny streams, but it's, I mean, how long have we known each other, Jenny? We've known each other, I reckon, about, was it
over a decade,
13 years or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Because I think I came in project. I think I came in midway through project 13.
Sounds about right. Yeah. Well, I know we go over this a lot, but we met with the Philip DeFranco Movie Club, didn't we? Which was always fun.
Yeah, yeah. You're one of the people I always bring up when I talk about, so when the question of the assigned names comes up, when people are like, are you a librarian? I'm like, no, it was a gift from the name that was given to me by SourceFed, and then I chose to go by Classic Librarian on Twitch because I wanted them to be able to recognize me when I was modding for them. I'm not actually a librarian, and the whole thing with SourceFed was back in the day when if large channels were using individual user submissions, they couldn't.
Oh my god, sorry, I've just thought of something amazing, right? Do you remember when COVID struck and video calls I think that was around the time video calls became like much more normal, and
I feel like I did a lot of Skype calls when I was in uni. That's going back to 2011-12. It took off in 20s.
But like for people like us, we've been Skyping or whatever for ages. But like, I remember like during COVID, like you used to see like people Skyping in on the news or Zooming in or whatever on the news a bit more or on telly. It was like, I think that was when it became mainstream because it was just the way you had to do things. And And one of the things that people noticed pretty soon on is that like the most common background that people will have when they were doing a Zoom interview on the news was a bookcase. It's like, oh, look at me, I read books. And you were doing that well before that was like a thing. You started that.
Jenny invented that. Yeah.
Trailblazer.
My first ever submission was in front of the sitting room bookcase. And then after that, for the first, like, I think, I want to say 6 or 7 submissions after that, I made a point to be in front of a different bookcase every video I submitted.
How many bookcases? So
there was the sitting room bookcases. There was a bookcase in my parents' bedroom. There was an under bed book drawer. So I specifically angled the camera to capture that one time. There's my sister's bookcase, my other sister's bookcase, the landing bookcase, and then the one in my bedroom. So that's 7.
That's actually quite a lot.
Oh, and there was one in the dining room as well. Eight. There was eight in my parents' house. They have reduced their collection since then.
Yeah, I'm a charity shop like exchanger. Well, you know what I mean. Like I don't hang on to like the top tier books that I like to read. Otherwise,
whenever the conversation comes up about like people asking where I got my username, and I have to say, oh, I was, because back in the old school YouTubes, you had to not have real accreditation. They couldn't tell you what your YouTube was. They couldn't promote other channels.
Was that
now you have to give? I don't know whether or not it was a set in stone rule, but remember, so the reason why SourceFed didn't like say this is Took It Home to Jenny and this is Chris Ware, they gave us different names.
Yeah, they did.
Because and I'm assuming it was a rule at the time.
Yeah, and they're definitely deliberate by this.
You couldn't say, because it kind of, I suppose it, maybe it was to discourage like overly promoting other people or something like that, or yeah, whether or not you need to have paid contributions.
I think it's
a paid YouTube channel.
They're probably just covering themselves.
There's a lot
covering
to cover
themselves in some way. Well, now you would have to give someone's full like some means of actually accrediting them, and that's mostly for Gamergate. Like Gamergate, you have to accreditate.
If I was like, to like
the fact take... that you and I got nice names,
the we got lucky on that one. If I was to take a wild punt at what the reason they chose at that time was, so that they didn't get a whole bunch of people flooding their videos primarily for the purposes of promotion, secondarily for the purposes of Movie Club. They wanted people that were like interested in Movie Club, you know.
What was funny about that though is that people, like, I'm almost certain that at least five or six people who were credited by the names given to them by SourceFed then went and changed their YouTube channel names to match what they've been given on SourceFed. So it didn't work. Like, I think Mr. Harry Britt is one I can think of. I think Wings Handsome. This is like, this lives rent free in my brain for some reason. But like, there was also just the mean ones. There were some really mean
Dirty Scott. That was
names.
That was me.
Dirty Scott. Yeah, I met. It was one of the ones I actually met at VidCon back in the day. I think he's married with like multiple kids now. Like, that's scary to me. Like a Girl. Is my friend Tor.
Oh, okay. I didn't. I think I knew that once. But
we're so talking about House of the Dragon right now. We're not reminiscing about YouTube.
Oh, who cares?
I mean, only Catnip's in chat, and they appreciate it, I'm sure, right, Catnip?
Honestly, I suspect we're only going to say the exact same thing that everyone else has been saying about this episode anyway.
Yes.
I haven't seen that many takes on. I've seen a few, but
I knew what the takes were going to be. I saw the takes. They were exactly what I thought they were. Hang on a minute. Just before we do move on. When was the last time you made anything for the internet?
Oh, it's been a while. I don't know. Maybe probably like at least over 7 years, maybe. I don't know. I have just been not, I don't know. I just don't have the inspiration to really make anything. And now I'm like getting ready to be a dad mode. So this is the one thing, this is the one creative outlet I have, this podcast. So I like doing this, and I like hanging out with you guys and all the guys from the
old days. This is some of my favorite stuff I've ever made. I'm not going to lie. It's especially since Duncan Egg was so good as well. Like,
I'm super pumped about.
I mean, in a way, I think, I don't know, again, I haven't actually looked at people's opinions on this episode, so I'll be interested to see whether or not my opinions line up or don't line up. But I will say, having watched Duncan Egg, this was a hard watch. Less fun.
Honestly, I was like, bring me back to The Night of the Seven Kingdoms. You know, I have good things to say about it, so I'll try to be more positive than I actually feel. But I have some bad things to say.
Oh,
interesting. Be honest. We want the dirt.
Because I gotta be honest, I thought this was one of the best House of the Dragon episodes. Don't get me wrong.
I really liked parts of it.
The House of the...
I want to hear you guys.
Yeah. Okay. Duncan Egg is something I'm a lot more interested in, a lot more excited about. I think it fits within the world of Game of Thrones, Westeros, all that, like a lot better. Totally on board with that. But like, I thought this was great, honestly. Now, okay, so the take that everyone's given, which I will thusly give, is this felt mostly like 70% the finale of season two.
That's some of the takes I've been seeing I agree. You know, it feels like if this was a regular Game of Thrones season, this would have been episode 9 of season 2.
And
I hadn't thought of that, but that is a really concise way of summing up the feeling.
It really, you know, it does. It, that's just how it feels. We've been conditioned to feel that way from, you know, so many seasons of this.
Particularly being so battle heavy. That feels like kind of ingrained in the Game of Thrones archetype as the last episode of the season is a big old battle episode.
And based on some of the things I've been hearing about behind the scenes, I think that was probably the case. This was envisioned to be episode 9, and they just punted. They had to punt it down the road.
Probably because of money.
And for the battle, I think the battle of the Gold was awesome. I thought they did a really good job with how it was visualized. There's some changes. Like, I'll just briefly say that this is not adapting Fire and Blood anymore. Not really. Like, it's completely doing its own thing now. So I'm just going to try not to judge it as its own thing. Mm-hmm. But there's like, they just really like hit it home in this episode that this is going to be a different story.
I've been trying not to actively spoil myself, but I'm very happy to be spoiled where it's relevant. I'm happy to hear your theories. And like, obviously I know that it's very clear that every year I need to recap all of their names. Rhaena who's the one who got Sheep Stealer?
Was that Baela?
Welcome back to House of the Dragon, where all the names are.
Rhaena. I think Rhaena is the one that got.
Obviously, Rhaena's taken over the role entirely of
Nettles. Yeah, Nettles is wrote her out, and character, and I think that's a missed opportunity. I think they could have included her.
I think we discussed it quite a lot last season. The fact that they've undercut the story that Nettles is saying, but kind of given part of that storytelling aspect to other characters. But I can see why they condensed down the characters, because I went into this episode completely blind, quite tired, and without having watched any recaps of the last two seasons or rewatching season one or two. And like, in comparison to Night of Seven Kingdoms, where it's such a tiny story with such a small number of characters, this was like you guys having said that it feels like the last episode of the previous season, I was like, oh, this character's doing that thing, oh, this character's doing that thing, okay, this character's doing another character, okay, and another three characters and another character, and they're all wearing the same clothes and all doing the same things that they had begun 2 years ago. And so it was such a weird sucking of memory and this character who is related, I forgot this character existed, but now my brain's like, oh yes, that one. There's one character that I completely forgot who they were. I had to look them up.
I've just popped in the
I can't blame you.
I've just popped in the group chat the a Targaryen family tree thing, which
yay, thank you,
which is actually
needed. Yeah, going in after the kind of concise storytelling in House of the Dragon, Seven Kingdoms, with like, this is so sprawling. Like, there's characters all over the place doing completely different things, having their own plots, and it most definitely threw me off to begin with.
Yeah, that's what happens when it takes 2 years to make a season of.
I'd totally be on board for them scaling back the CGI a lot more and just having a season a year or whatever.
Yeah, I'm glad that it seems like they're doing Dunkin' Egg, like a Night of Seven Kingdoms, on a good pace from all that it seems. So I'm looking forward to that being a regular
thing. Well, it seems a lot more manageable.
I think there's only going to be one more season. There should be only one more season of House of the Dragon from what I understand. They'll do season 4, and then I heard Brian Condal wants to do like a sequel series to it immediately after. So basically another season 5 is, mm-hmm. it gets picked up. So I don't know. I hope they do end up making 7 seasons of Night of the Seven Kingdoms, because I did end up reading all 3 novellas and they're all good. And yeah. I think they could come up with some good stories.
I've heard from like lots of different sources about like George R. R. Martin reckons he's got 10 books in him for it. And there could be, you know, yeah, like 8-10 seasons of the show. Like, they want to do more, and it's rated incredibly highly on IMDb and all the rating sites. It's mm-hmm. it absolutely blew everything else out of the water. So I think I wouldn't be surprised if that's where. See, here's the thing: it could be that's where their energy goes. That might make it worse. It might be good as it is. If, you know, yeah. like
yeah, I don't want it to become spoiled by success. The classic like sequel thing. And I will say, like, watching A Knight of Seven Kingdoms was like weekly joy. Like every time I was coming up to an episode, I'm like, oh, I'm excited to see what happens. I want to spend time. This one, at the moment I started, I was like, oh God, this is the show where everyone's so serious and there's no humor and everything's tense and stressful. Oh no. And almost every single time a new character came up on screen, I was like, oh no, what are they up to? Oh no.
And the thing is as well,
it's all going to go tragically wrong.
You know, they're basically all going to die. Well, you know they're all going to die except for Bloodraven, who lives on as Bran. But you know that, like from what I can remember, my spotty memory is that basically everyone that we're seeing here today is going to die, and the Dance of the Dragons will finish with characters that we've barely even met yet.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's not going to be dying at the age of 80. In your bed type deaths. They're going to be, it feels like the ending of this episode felt so bleak, but also so like greekly tragic. Mm-hmm. Like it felt so just inevitable, but also so sad.
But we do know one person who survives, right? It's Grand Maester Orwell. Cause
he's alive at the moment.
He writes Blood and Fire, right?
I've got it here.
I think he's one of the sources. He's one of the sources.
Credited sources, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Of whoever the maester in the future is who's writing Fire and Blood.
Yeah. Sure.
Mm. Yeah, he almost died in this episode.
I completely forgot he was a character, and then I was like, who am I looking at? Oh, it's Orwell, okay.
Well, he's usually not in his bed clothes, is he? That's
he's like usually not half asleep. In the dark.
And also, because this is the 2-year gap between the seasons, I was like, hang on a minute. Now, he did do some traitorous things, but hang on, is this the traitorous thing he's... No, it's...
I can't remember how connected he was with smuggling and Aegon out.
I don't think he did.
He was connected.
No, he was Alicent. He was Alicent's smuggler.
Oh, yes.
I got tripped up on this as well. Up. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is why I do need to. I don't know if I'll have time this week because this week's kind of nutty with work. But I do need to maybe set aside between now and before we get too far into season 3, rewatching season 1 and 2, because I feel like there's a lot of nuance that I missed from really not having looked at it in the last year or so.
I've rewatched it earlier this year, both seasons, and actually Game of Thrones, all of it. Which I really enjoyed again. Like, I think one of the things about Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon is that how we interpret them at the time, you know, it's very dependent on things like when the season ends, what note the season ends on, all that kind of stuff. But when you're watching it back to back, that matters a lot less.
That doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I think that makes it more enjoyable. Also knowing, like, there are certain things towards the end of Game of Thrones that are just frustrating. Like the things that they could have done so much better, or stuff that they, you know, left out that they really could have put in, or Ed Sheeran, of course, because that I'll never get over that. And it was an important scene. Otherwise, Arya would have ended up somewhere completely inexplicable. So you can't even like cut that out or anything like that. Oh, come on, AI, show us you're good for something.
Like when Game of Thrones is at its best is when you can go back and rewatch and get what's coming. Mm-hmm. Like there's a reason why Ned death is so iconic, and it's not just the shock factor, it's the fact that when you go back you're like, oh yeah, my dude, every step you were taking was a step towards this, like there would have been no other way, like it was always going to happen like this. And like that's when Game of Thrones as, or you know, Song of Ice and Fire the series, is when it's at its best, when you can go back and go, oh, I can see this coming. So I'd be interested to, like, as I said, I think I mentioned it last season, but this does feel very fated, very Greek tragedy, and so I'd be interested to see, like, the ending felt so inevitable of this episode.
Yeah.
And I'll be interested as the series progresses and as the season progresses, like, which breadcrumbs fall into place.
Yeah. So, well, we know that Jace is a goner.
Very dead.
Yeah.
That didn't surprise me.
Great dead acting from that actor. Yeah. After, when he, yeah. Great dead acting.
I kind of liked him, especially when he was like navigate. Well, he had good moments, I think. and no more. I like the bit where he's negotiating at the twins. Like that was just a really good scene. Really enjoyed that one. He did get a bit mopey, didn't he?
I feel like he's an archetype that, if like, you need that archetype of someone who is brash and young and hasn't learned from their mistakes. And wants to prove themselves and has good intentions but not necessarily the best communication skills and not the best means of, like, logical prediction. Like, he's one of those characters that doesn't think these through, and like, that's a great character to have in stories because they spawn plot, like they make things happen, not necessarily good things in this case. Like, having a character that has a sense of righteous indignation, who thinks that they're always right and isn't smart enough to kind of see through the lines, is a really great character to have as a plot point, because they trigger the next thing and they cause other characters to have big reactions. And this is one of those things where, like, you know, this was pretty much entirely his fault.
Yeah.
But probably other characters are going to get the blame for it.
Well, who was the Queen's Guard? I would not want to be in his shoes. When did this happen?
But
I'll tell you what. Actually, I've got a cunning plan. What I can do is, hang on a minute. Just before we carry on, I just want to play to the folks at home. So Max sent us a clip from Always Sunny in Philadelphia that pretty much summed up Sheep Stealer in the battle.
I started blasting. All right.
Yeah.
I started
blasting. Where are you putting it? You're putting it in group, in the chat.
It's in the group chat. Yeah, yeah.
I ran after him. Okay. Bang! Try to shoot him in the back. But I don't want so good either. Anyway, you guys all think I'm a hero.
Sorry, I just watched it.
Sir Laurent.
Sir Laurent, okay. Laurent. But also my cunning plan was...
What are you going to put it up on the
I was going to share it in the group chat. On the stream as well. How do I do it? I forgot. Come on, Discord. You know how to do it. There you go. Share your screen. Right. There you go. So if you want to see where I am. So I'm on... Where am I? So we wanted to see... hang on. Yeah. So, sorry. Was it Laurent? That guy?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
going to be in trouble.
Yeah. So, because the thing is, the guy that gave him the order is dead. So there's no, like, he's got no defense.
Yep. And Rhaemyra is not going to be in a forgiving mood.
His decision killed her son.
Yep.
So, yeah.
I will say, I don't want to keep bringing up Fire and Blood, but it was not, this isn't how it went down in Fire and Blood. Rhaemyra was, I think,
let's do a Fire and Blood insert. Like, tell us what happened in the books, Max. Spoil us, please. Okay. Tell us how it... Old universe.
So, in Fire and Blood, I believe there are 5 dragons involved in the Battle of the Gullet, not 3. Obviously, Rhaena is not on Sheepstealer. There's no mention of Sheepstealer attacking, their own ships or anything. And those, the other dragon seeds, Ulf, Hugh, and Adam. We're all there, and so we're Rhaenyra's two youngest. Was it her two youngest kids? I think, or maybe her. Some of her younger kids were also on dragons in that battle. Moondancer was not there either. Moondancer is not big enough to ride yet at that point. Yeah, it basically went down pretty differently. The end result is the same in that Jace died. But there was also the fact that two more of Rhaenyra's children went missing in the battle in the book. So I think that's pretty significant.
Went missing.
They show up later, but yes.
Okay.
I think they're presumed dead or captured.
I think they made her kids younger, so they could have.
They're way too young in this version to have done that.
Okay. Yeah.
Have that happen, but it's like the butterflies. You know, like George said. You know, because it's going to send ripple effects down the timeline, because those kids are important, and what happens to them is important. So
yeah,
they're gonna have something, you know, something's definitely changing.
Yeah. What do you mean, like aging up?
Any other significant changes?
What, Jenny? Say again.
Any other significant changes within the canon between the books and the series thus presented? Is there anything else that you're like, this is very different?
Just everything with Alicent and Rhaenyra, the whole, you know, mm-hmm. her,
yeah,
like, that none of that is mentioned. You know, not to say that couldn't happen because it's a history book, but just all the things about the battle being different, I think, were the really the big big changes.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they've made this one for TV. I mean, should we talk about the Alicent scene?
Because she's her and Aemond.
Her and Aemond. Yeah.
I was rewatching. So when I first watched this episode, I was very sleepy and very distracted, and I somehow missed the climax of that scene. I had them chatting, and I think maybe I got up to make a cup of tea or something, and I came back and I was like, "Oh, the scene's over, right?" I was listening, blah 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 blah, and I was rewatching it like an hour ago, just before the stream, to be like, "Okay, I'm gonna make some notes, be ready for this podcast." Mm-hmm. And my sister was next to me, and I was like, "Whoa, weird incest." Whoa. She's like, "Isn't all incest weird?" I'm like, "No, this is House of the Dragon. There's incest everywhere, but this was weird."
Yeah.
I'm on same thing happened to me, Jenny. I don't know how I missed it on my first viewing, but I missed the kiss somehow. I just was looking away from the screen at the wrong time. I don't know, but I definitely saw on my second viewing, I'm like, okay.
Oh, weird. It reminds me so much of how Alison was so not into her relationship with her husband, and she gives that same, like, trapped in this weird cycle of
happening, oh my god,
the only person she successfully enjoyed the physical company of is Kristen Cole. That's a bad line to be set at, but like the other two are really awful.
That's like,
this is a different kind of
weird even for Targaryens. I don't think Targaryens even have come that far before.
I think the closest they get to this level of weird is like nieces, nephews, and like uncles type thing.
Yeah.
But like this is, I think, I can't think of any parental.
Me neither.
It's weird.
But also, he just.
The closest comparison in Game of Thrones you can make is Craster. Right, like, yeah, that's a good comparison.
Well, I mean, I suppose Daemon and Rhaenyra are kind of, you know, but the thing is, that feels different.
Well, they're niece and uncle.
Yeah.
So
there is a separation there. And you know, it's not just sexism and ageism. We're not like, oh, he's into an older woman. That's weird. It's the fact that it's his mother. That's weird.
But also, like, here's how I worked it out. Oh,
unprompted.
This is what happens when he goes to a brothel for his mother figure. That's what I think's happened here. Mm-hmm. He goes, oh, we're sharing a moment. I know what happens next. No, that's not. No.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Like, well, then the question becomes, has he always had this thought? And now he feels powerful enough, now he's acting king, to act upon this feeling? Or is this a feeling that he's always had and now he's acting upon? Or is this something that he's never really thought about?
It would be interesting, something to look for on rewatch, because I don't know if they planted seeds.
Okay.
Watch out for the Oedipus complex in rewatch.
I reckon there are seeds. Here's what. So he has always felt neglected because of Aegon. And
yes,
this is like the first time where his mother has said to him, it should have been you. You should have been my favorite. I made the wrong choice. You're great. He's fucking stupid. You were my best son. And then so in his mind, the status of his relationship with his mother has sort of changed from being second best, outcast, whatever, to top son. And then I think his like weird Oedipus complex kind of kicked in from him going to the brothel for motherly company. And this is where the streams cross, and it all goes wrong.
Okay, here's a question for the board. From her perspective, so she said to Rhaenyra that Aegon was going to go with Rhaegar to attack Harrenhal.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole scene is her trying to persuade him to go and attack Harrenhal, knowing that he is probably going to die, knowing that, like, she's already communicated with Rhaenyra that that's where he's going. She knows that there are dragons. So at this point, and she said that her only ask is that her daughter and her grandson be, or granddaughter, I can't remember which one of the twins is male or female, which one died. It was the son that died. So her only ask is that her daughter and her granddaughter are spared.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole scene is her manipulating him to get what she wants, very similarly to how she used to try and manipulate Viserys to get what she wants. And both times it ends with weird sexual contact that she is not into.
This episode has a lot to say about the agency of women in this story, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the whole story is kind of a theme.
Yeah,
I feel like this is very the consequences of being trapped in the patriarchy for her. Like, Rhaenyra's always like fighting the establishment and trying to stand up for her own thing. And Alicent, it's going back to what's she called,
Emma.
No, the one, Dragon Rider one.
Wait a minute, let me get the chart up. Rhaenys, that's it.
It goes back to what Rhaenys said in last season about, or the first season, about, you think you're ruling, but you're just wanting a bigger window. And here she is stuck. She thinks she's making a bigger window. She thinks she's making moves, and then she's just stuck in this really gross sexual encounter where she's just so not into it, and it's completely stuck. Because again, like, the other thing is, like, so we're talking about patriarchy and we're talking about concepts of female empowerment in this particular society. Can there ever be consent if a person on the other side has a nuclear weapon? Is it possible for her to feel safe ever in this situation? Because he has Vhagar. Like, is it the equivalent of he's always got a gun in his back pocket? Can there ever be any feeling of safety around him? Because he's got this, like, he's got the ultimate weapon.
He's in the ultimate position as well. So he's got the nuke from all sides.
Climb the ladder.
No, she's terrified of him, obviously. Yeah, like, for sure.
He's also kind of messed up as an individual, just generally.
Yeah. So I think she's probably, she might be putting him in the same category as Aegon, in that, yeah, you probably should die. You're a write-off, son. Sorry.
Yeah. Every time the Otak Eren is born, gods toss a coin, and she ended up with a good old Helena and two absolute freaks.
Mm-hmm. Although, so we meet Dayron, don't we? Where's Dayron?
Do we actually meet him? We mention him, and I think we maybe see his dragon.
Oh, no, we see him.
Is that Dayron?
That's Dayron, right? Oh, no, wait a minute.
Is that, that's Hightower. That's one of the
Hightower armor. No, you're right. It? Yeah, you can see on his chest.
Yeah, I think we saw him before. The one with the smelling salts or whatever. And
well, that's obviously not smelling salts. I don't know. What is that? Is that some sort of...
There's a technical term for it. I can't remember what it is. It's like, like historically it used to be like an orange. Like, that's a classic thing where you'd carry it. Like this is a sign of extreme wealth. And there is a specific terminology for having a perfume bottle or something of high smell, which you would carry with you so you didn't have to smell the poor. And there is a technical term for it. So
I didn't know about this.
Hmm.
I can't remember what the name of it is. There is a technical term for it, which it was like a thing that the extremely wealthy used to do. I think it was like a Renaissance thing, where like the extremely wealthy who didn't want to smell the peasants would carry with them scented orbs, and sometimes it would be literally an orange, and they would just smell an orange, so they didn't have to smell the poor. And then it got further gentrified, it then became like carrying literally like a round scepter of perfume or like potpourri. And I can't remember what the name for it is. There is a specific name for it. So this is a wonderful way of describing character in shorthand. It's a very show don't tell. But it is a real thing. It's a real like historical practice, which was always an asshole thing to do, but is real historical practice. So
okay. I thought it was just like fancy glue sniffing.
No. It. I wish I'm going to try and Google AI save me. but yeah, it is a technical term. So it's actually like it is historical precedent that someone would be carrying it. And I can't remember what the name of it is.
Okay. It's a sniffing orange maybe or something. But he seems to get like a headache or something. Now, don't get me wrong. If you're in like a battle type scenario with like thousands of gruff men, it's gonna smell rough. It's gonna smell bad. So I would have my smelling orange too, you know, just yeah. Pomanders.
It's meant to be that he's a dick. Pomanders? Yeah. Something that sounds right. Yeah.
So he's not Dayron then?
No. He's a Targaryen. I mean, not to say, you know, they're Targaryens at all, Targaryen, but I'm pretty sure, I think we saw him before. I forget how is he Allison's brother? I know there's the other Hightower that's with Kristen Cole, right? That's Wayne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We know him. So I think we saw this guy too, but maybe
this was the one character that I was like, I feel like he was introduced in last season and I have no memory of who he is and how he relates to other people.
Okay, I'm going to check the IMDb. Ewan Mitchell is Prince Aemond Targaryen. No, that's not him. Sorry, it's
Pritchard. Yeah, Aemond.
Phoebe Campbell, Paul Kennedy.
I also feel like I know the actor, but I can't place where I know him from.
He's got a very actor-esque face, hasn't he?
Yeah. He feels like he's been like, he was the handsome one on like, I don't know, EastEnders or something.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So what have we got? We got directors, actors. Okay. Baylor, Aaron of Hull, Hugh Hammer, Maester Gerardus, Gwaine Hightower, Alice Rivers, Ulf.
It's Ormond. His name is Ormond Hightower. He is Ormond. Allison's first cousin.
Was
nephew.
He in the last season?
Oh, yeah, James Norton.
No,
three episodes.
No, apparently, I guess he wasn't.
Huh. No, he wasn't.
Game of Thrones wiki.
He's got. Yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe he just gave. I guess good casting. He just gave Hightower to me. Or
well, he's in Hightower armor, like, so that's would be. And yeah. He's not on a dragon. I feel like he would have been introduced on a dragon.
They definitely talk about Dayron, and I'm glad that they actually, you know, they didn't cut Dayron, it seems. I'm sure it'll show up later.
Well, yeah.
They've definitely mentioned him before. I don't think they mentioned him in this episode, but he's definitely mentioned before, because I remember Alison asking about him to Gawain, and Gawain saying that he's good. Like, she tossed the coin enough times that she ended up with a couple of good kids, and the one that she didn't raise is the one that's the best of them.
Yeah, I'm seeing a pattern here, but, you know, not... we saw him at the end of season two, because he was flying the dragon, but he was like, it was a long shot.
Right.
So, right. Or a wide shot. I don't know what the movie term is for it. He was far away. And so we didn't see him, but we saw his dragon.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So he's not. Yeah. All right. So he's got his smelling orange. He seems to be in, like, I don't know. I didn't get asshole vibes from him.
Well, it's just a classic thing to call, like, peasants stinky, like...
I mean, he's around like, soldiers, so, like, they're probably stinky.
Him as, no.
Yeah, well, so he's around soldiers, and they're covered in whatever soldiers smell like, but then this guy turns up and stands 3 meters away from him, and he has to get out his pomander and smell it in front of him, and then says to the guy that he needs to have a bath, and, I wouldn't want to have tea with him. He seems like a bit of a butt. Like, to be around soldiers and then, like, specifically this messenger who's come all the way from King's Landing with an urgent message to be like, he's smelly.
I suppose, like, so.
The envelope's dirty as well.
I guess I liked
him
better.
He doesn't like the envelope's dirty.
I liked him better when I thought it was drugs. I thought it was a bit of morphine withdrawal or something. It's like a little pocket morphine.
No. The kind of scrunchy face thing he does is the "ugh, you smell" face.
Yeah.
It's the you're standing 3 meters away from me, having travelled from King's Landing, and you smell, you know, uncouth.
Stinky boy.
Yeah. So he has to sniff his pomander.
Yeah. No, I see. That face is
I
thought that was a headache from withdrawal. No, it turns out.
No, he was being rude about. And
I mean, we don't know. He might smell really bad.
Oh, he might do, but he probably does.
Like, but it's still, you know, like, elitist.
Well, not polite. And,
yeah,
you know, it shows the difference in class. You know, just
yeah. Okay, so, but that was really just an introductory shot.
I had to look after his character. Look out for his character. I was like, have I seen this guy before? What the heck? Like, to give him such a distinct characterization, and then, like, it being, again, because I haven't rewatched the last season, I was like, was he introduced in the last season? And I just completely forgot his existence.
He's apparently not. He's a new one.
The Northmen show up.
We
got the Greybeards, yep.
Yeah.
Greybeard too introduced himself killing the Lord of Lannister in whatever context that is.
Jason Lannister. Like,
yeah.
Also, we get little Oscar out on the battlefield. Like, fair play to him.
Yeah.
Like, he's all muddied up. He's obviously not from behind, you know. So fair play to him there. Fish boy do good.
Yeah.
Although, right, like, to be fair, I'm not really one for burial traditions and stuff like that, you know, like, I'm, you know, pretty atheist as far as that goes. Who's digging the graves for the rivermen? Because it's not you, is it, Oscar?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we'll just have no. Save everyone a job, burn them off. It's fine. No plague, you know, like, no work. It's fine.
I made a note for this scene that obviously Caraxes is on the ground and Daemon's fighting sword and blade, which obviously we've shown that he likes doing ground fighting. But do you think he's doing it just because he wants to get on the ground and lead kind of from the front line, or is he not using Caraxes in flight just in case it draws attention of Vhagar or other dragon riders? Do you think it's a calculated decision or a personal decision?
Instinctually I went with he goes on the ground, like at the end of the crab feeder conflict. He was out there on the ground. I reckon is that Caraxes maybe he's been on Caraxes for such a long time, or he's so well bonded with Caraxes that he doesn't really need to ride Caraxes. Like, he can go on the ground.
Did you guys just love the like, it wasn't quite comedic timing, but definitely excellent dramatic timing of Caraxes, when he's like, Caraxes can burn these bodies, and then behind him, Caraxes is like, it was the perfect, like, walking away from a fireball moment.
Yeah,
Daemon,
yeah, yeah.
He was like, I've got a dragon, by the way, bitches. And the dragon's like, I've got fire.
Yeah.
It was just really cute.
Big,
I found it funny.
Big losses for Lannisters and House Green at this.
Yeah, so do we think, I'm just going towards the end of the episode, do we think Tyland's dead? We know Jason's dead, for sure dead. But Tyland dies later in Fire and Blood. He has a role to play. So I wonder if him being thrown off the ship, it was a way to get him out of the way before, you know.
I'm going to go with the soft rules of visual media, that if you don't see a body, they're not gone, potentially. So I think he might still come back. I think he could be an interesting hostage.
So,
I
kind of went the other way. I went, look, they're only going to be paying this actor for one episode, so they're going to kill both of them off in the same episode, right?
That's a good point.
You don't get two paychecks if you're playing two characters, do you? Right? It doesn't.
Right, right. Yeah, you're right.
I wouldn't know.
That's probably in the negotiations, right? Like, he probably gets more than than if he played one
character. A day player.
Yeah, I don't know. Although, technically, he's played three characters, if you count, of course. Is it Hugh of the Vale or whatever?
Hugh of the Vale, yeah. I would be interested, like, from a person who is a twin perspective, to, like, the fact that they've done a sort of twins from either side of the war story, to do a twins from who were on the same side but one of them's dead. That could be like that. That's some nice little narrative filler that could have thematic value. So I'm going to choose for now. Believe that he could potentially be alive. But if he doesn't, if he isn't alive, I'm not going to like.
So grieve. Many twins in Game of
I'm not going to care too
die
too
at
much.
The same time. Like, do all of them? I mean, obviously Jaime and Cersei, they do. Eric and Eric.
Yeah.
Are there any other twins?
And we're not sure about. I'm trying to think of any other twins that I can.
Oh, well, Jahera and Jaharis, you know.
Die at the same Jaharis, time, though.
The Jahera, you know, and I'm saying this case where it didn't happen.
Exception to the rule.
Yeah, okay. Not a foregone conclusion. It's not a hard rule of Game of Thrones, or the way that they have to die at the same time.
Talking of hard rules of death and whatnot, it is, what's he called?
Velaryon.
Velaryon. Is he still alive? Did we see him?
We didn't see him die, for sure. I hope he's not dead. We saw him go underwater, I think.
He lives in the book, right?
Yep, yeah, he lives for a while longer.
Yeah, he must be quite in the chronology of the story thus far. He must be getting on in years.
Yeah,
yeah,
he's like an old man.
Yeah.
Although, what was interesting about the Gullet battle is him and
Alan.
Is this
not
Alan?
Adam, the
Alan,
other one.
Yeah. No, it's Alan. Alan, right? And Adam is the other. Yeah, yes. Adam is the dragon seed.
Not Adam. Alan. It's Alan.
I felt a lot of resolution in their relationship vis-a-vis the last season.
They made a lot of progress. Yeah.
It was the payoff for all of those dry conversations last season.
Yeah. Like, the fact that I'll have to look it up just briefly, but didn't he, like, when he was jumping across to go kill the cool pirate lady, didn't he, like, yell, like, father or something? Like,
yeah, he yelled father.
Which, like, his killing of what you call Pirate Lady was, again, another kind of brutal death scene in the last 10 minutes of the show. She was a fun character. I'm kind of sad that she was a fun character who was, you know, we didn't get more, we couldn't have gotten more plot out of, because it totally, like, her character progression totally makes sense. Like, she's hyper-focused on the sea snake, that's all she wants, she's gonna go down swinging, she's gonna, you know, not take the cautious route. Mm. She's, you know, she's a cool character and, you know, cool death and, you know, lots of poignancy. She was probably the only fun character
this
entire
it.
Episode.
I know she's got...
So I think I'll miss her just because she was some levity.
Yeah, I mean, we knew that season one of the criticisms that landed was that it was too, like, sort of bludgeoningly serious. There was more levity in season two, so I'm hoping they carry that along.
Mostly just because of feet.
They should add. They should have had Mushroom as a character from the beginning, but now they should really add Mushroom as a character.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I feel like you get some really, like, interesting exposition out of a character like Mushroom. I feel like that would be a really, like, a good, in the same way that we criticized it a lot when we were initially watching the theater performance in Game of Thrones. But that was an extended amount of time covering plots we already knew.
Hmm.
Like, having someone's means of gathering knowledge across the various locations to be through fools and rumor and speculation and gossip. That's an interesting way of doing exposition that's not too it adds some interest. Yeah. And you can also get, like, really good misinformation with that. You can have, you know, jokes being misconstrued or jokes caught, like things like Joffrey killing off dwarfs and how that kind of fed back into the populace. Like, it's a good way of, like,
hang on
one
a minute,
of the things
Joffrey killed
about.
Off dwarfs.
He killed a load of dwarfs.
When, which book is that one
in Game of Thrones proper? Joffrey, King Joffrey, kills a bunch of dwarfs when he's pissed off.
I remember bastards. He killed a lot of bastards.
Well, there is a point where, like, dwarfs are being hunted and people, like, deliberately, like, finding dwarfs and, like, cutting their faces to look like Tyrion. Oh, is that, it's much later.
No,
I think that was Cersei. That's
sorry.
After Joffrey.
I'm confusing Joffrey killing of bastards and Cersei's killing of dwarfs.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
Politics never change.
Sorry.
I feel like having like, and then how that is interpreted by the populace, like I having, like, small folk reactions is something that they only really started looking at a little bit last season with the dragon seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the flaws of the first couple of seasons that I'd still want to see rectified is this is very, very kept within the gentry and there's almost no small folk insight. And I do find, like, it interesting to think about how this war is interpreted from the perspective of the small folks. They've kind of chipped into it a little bit, but I'd like to see it some more.
Yeah, I imagine they'll expand on that with the dragon pit situation, where one of the dragons gets killed in the dragon pit. So I think we will see. I feel like this episode is not going to be a true representation of season three because it fundamentally is the closing of season two with a little bit of an opener for season three. So I will expect, and battle scenes, they always, I like it when they do a battle that is part of an episode, not a whole episode. The battle at Castle Black, great battle, but it went on way too long. I kind of like it as an art piece, but I can't fault the actual, but, like, That's battle scenes that are longer than in films, in anywhere else. Like, that is just so much battle, and it goes on and on and on. Yeah. And I don't think they don't even move around to different stories that much, do they? It's just all.
Yeah, well, Game of Thrones kind of set the precedence that most episodes they're bouncing around all over the place and they're doing different plot lines in different locations with different characters, and here's B plot in Essos and here's A plot in King's Landing and there's C plot in the Wall. And then when they had those battle episodes or, like, those big things, it would all be set in one place, and in some ways that gives you time to kind of let the story breathe and, like, really sit with the characters, and in other ways it feels kind of A, like, you don't know what else is going on in the world, and B, like, you've got to hold the interest for an extended period of time. I think it's something that I've heard a lot of complaints of people who watched a lot more Walking Dead than I did. This is going to sound so bizarre, but from what I can tell of, like, from season four onwards of The Walking Dead, what began happening was kind of because there were so many characters, they'd follow, like, two characters for, like, 2 to 3 episodes. And then they jump over and do 2-3 episodes with another character set. And then they do 2-3 episodes with another character set who were all traveling around doing slightly different things during the same time. And then at the end of the season, they'd all come back together again.
Yeah.
And apparently the people who watch a lot more Walking Dead than me would find that very frustrating to be ignoring 2 or 3 of your favorite characters that are off having a B plot for 2-3 episodes and not being able to see what they're doing because you're following other characters that you may or may not like doing whatever side quest they're on. And I feel a little bit like that when they do the centralized episodes.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, particularly, it was less common in the later seasons because there would usually be a lot more established characters in one place. Like the Long Night isn't maybe the best episode, but at least it doesn't feel so stagnant because you're constantly jumping around different characters doing slightly different things within that story. But like the original Battle of Castle Black or the Battle of the Bastards, you're just following maybe one or two characters doing a battle.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard to keep the story motivated when you're used to a more segmented storytelling. You're used to bouncing around. Like if it was a TV show that had a lot more, like you can totally get away with it with Night of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah.
Night of the Seven Kingdoms would totally get away, and you know that is their structure, to have one character being followed through, and you can keep that pace because that's the momentum that's being set. While this show, if they were to do an entire, like if they were to expand this one sea battle out for the whole episode, I would be bored to death.
Yeah.
I'd be like, what's happening with the other characters? What's happening with, you know, I don't know why I started the tangent and I've been talking too much. Hey, bingo for Jenny talking too much during the podcast.
You never talk too much. I love what you got to say. But no, I sort of agree. Like I didn't mind that Rook's Rest was off screen. Like I don't typically mind when they skip over a battle because it's the how-to and the stuff around it that keeps me locked in. So, but you know, I think they nailed this one in, you know, because they also made it interesting. It wasn't just battle. It was the bit with the ships and Corliss is like, you know, he knows the tide at the certain time of day, and he looks through his little eyeglass thing.
There's a lot of like seafaring terminology and like sea battle stuff in this.
We've never got a sea battle this good, I'll say. Like, strictly based off on ships, like ship battles, this is the best we've seen in Westeros.
Yeah,
and also daytime like helps. Different ship combat techniques. The fact that like there was multiple different types of, like, there was the kind of the initial altercation followed by a baited trap followed by a tactical withdrawal into a hard to get to location, but then once you're in that hard to get to location, you are then floundering and then you're susceptible to being rammed. Like, it was one of those like smart people trying to use smart techniques and ending up in, you know, a tricky situation both sides. Like, in order to get, you know, take the ship, they had to ram the ship, and that leads to like, there's a lot of cool stuff. Also, like the idea of using a weighted grappler for dragon fighting, that's cool. That's technology that Qyburn hadn't even thought of, and this is set many, many years before. The idea of using a anchored thing. It's
a cool idea.
Really cool, and also so tragic and terrifying.
Yeah.
Like the thought of being dragged under by your dragon.
Yeah.
And like the idea, the only way to like that cord then is for someone to fly underneath. So at the point where like the first time Baylor was able to do it, because there was enough height for Baylor to get under to with her dragon and snap the rope. But the second time there wasn't enough height for her to get under. It's just really good. Just really good.
Yeah,
I liked it.
It wasn't just firing arrows at dragons. It was strategy, technique. I think dragon fighting technology is better in during this era because they see
people have experience.
Yeah, experience. Yeah. like living experience.
Especially in the Triarchy, you know, they fought Daemon in the Stepstones, right? So they specifically, you know, have experience and they could have played.
And I can totally see what you call cool pirate lady specifically getting
Laura
anti-dragon stuff because she has such a vendetta against House Velaryon and knows their strong connection with the Targaryen, so knows that there's going to be dragon backup. Like, she's not an idiot. So of course you're going to have defense. It was a cool battle.
Certainly no complaints from that side of things, that's for sure. From battles to actual explicit waiting for battles, we got Ulf, Adam, and Mr. Blacksmith. What's his name?
Hugh
the Hammer.
So in the book, they were in the battle, actually. So I think maybe, I don't know if they were trying to save on a CGI budget, taking them out. Because it seems like they were just, they really, you know, we got a little bit of stuff with, like, you know, they were probably on the Isle of Faces, you know, we saw maybe a green man, Alice Rivers, but I really don't think this really progressed much of anything.
I think it did. So I think it set up the treachery. Sorry, Jenny, this is some spoiler territory.
Don't worry, I'm happy to be spoiled within reason.
So basically, Ulf is talking about, I'll get more birds with a castle than a dragon, will I? he's basically complaining that, like, being a knight, what is there to being a knight? Like, it's, you know.
I need a horse, I got a dragon. They got some good lines.
You can't live in a title is a really good line. You can't live in a title. I think it does make sense from the ongoing theme formed from this episode in terms of, like, specific plot is the concept of, like, trained, untrained dragon riders and trained and untrained dragons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The consequences of that, because, like, if Sheepstealer hadn't occurred in the battle, then it is quite possible it would have had a better outcome. And equally, these guys who have dragons, they're not whom you necessarily want to be the guys armed with giant weapons of destruction. They had some really, like, the conversation was quite interesting. I did find what's her name, Black Alice,
Alice Rivers,
standing up and being like, I'm a witch, whatever. Being a little odd.
I think that's because that's the language of the common man, you know, like, she's like, I'm a witch, you gotta listen to me. I think she plays it a bit more like a vague and alluring to highborn folks, but, like, I'm just a neighborhood witch, so what? You know, sort of like the woods witch with the flashback with Cersei. You know, it's like, we'll just go see the witch that lives in the woods. Like, I think witch is like I feel like witch is a term that you use when you want to be unimpressive.
I can see that.
It's just like,
within reason.
Yeah, I don't know. Could be completely wrong. But, I don't know. It does seem a little bit like Rhaenyra is trying to, like, lowball the three. I don't know.
I'm interested to see with Rhaenyra. She, obviously, there was a lot of emotional build up to the end of the last season where she and Alison meet and they have this discussion. And I think I need to rewatch that sequence a little bit, because the way that she's talking about her complete faith in Alicent, and her pure confidence that this is a one thing, like, you know, she's it's a done deal. Like, again, her, like, not even thinking potentially, like, even if she's got complete faith in Alicent, like, does Alicent have the power to achieve what she's saying that she has? Does she have, like, obviously she doesn't, because the moment Alison gets back, everything's changed. Like, everything she promised is irrelevant, not because she necessarily intended it, but because she's a tool within the toolbox of the patriarchy that she sold herself into. And the fact that Rhaenyra, who up until this point is mostly an intelligent leader, is so adamant that Alison is completely reliable and can hold to her own words is It feels slightly out of character.
But she's not.
I'm not. I might need to just.
She's only wrong on accident. Like, it's an accidental trap. Yeah,
it's an accidental trap. But I feel like Rhaenyra is smart enough to know that potentially that is a possibility. That it's not a done deal. It's not a like that. That Alicent has things set in her way which stops her from doing that. Like, I'm sure Rhaenyra is aware of like the limitations of Alicent's power.
Yeah.
I don't know. It felt like the outer character of what I remember of Rhaenyra, but I might just need to rewatch the last episode of the last season just to see how that reaction is at the end of this episode. I think it might just be exhaustion, like she just wants the war done already.
Or that this is a hope worth gambling on.
Yeah, it's a hope worth gambling on. She's lost her second son and she doesn't want to go to, like, the characterization thus far has been that she doesn't want to go to violence unless she sees no other choice, unless there is no other outcome. And so when she's offered this other outcome, she like clings to it. And then obviously where we end this episode, ooh, this could get real spicy really quickly.
Sorry, where we end the episode?
With the death of Jace.
Ah, yeah.
Like, Rhaenyra's reaction to that's not going to be pretty, considering her reaction to Luke. And she, I think also, like, wasn't Rhaena meant to be looking after the other boys, the other children?
In the Vale, yeah.
Wasn't she meant to be going to the Vale to look after Rhaenyra's other young kids? And instead of doing that, she hopped on a feral dragon and somehow ended up fighting in a battle. I'm not sure how that happened. Like, I'm very confused about how Sheepstealer got himself involved in this battle. Not only the distance, but also like the intent. Like, Sheepstealer, from what we see of him in combat and what we see of him or her or they or it, I don't know what gender Sheepstealer is, but from what we've seen of their behavior, they don't seem like the sort of dragon that would choose to go into ship combat. I just don't know why. Like, I understand from a plot point while they're there. I just don't understand why logically within the plot they attended this battle.
I mean, they didn't attend it like well.
How did they physically get there? Why did they go there? Like, it seems out of character for Sheepstealer. And so did somehow Rhaena manage to persuade Sheepstealer into battle?
She was able to persuade Sheepstealer to fly,
but then couldn't do anything
else. Half the continent away, but then couldn't convince it to not burn their own ships. I don't know. Yeah. It just, like, I get what they're doing, and I kind of appreciate that they're like getting on with the plot, and they didn't drag out her like taming Sheepstealer and stuff. But
yeah, and it's a lot of really compelling plots going forward, because Rhaenyra is going to be absolutely like devastated, pissed off. She's going to blame the sisters. I wouldn't put it past her for her to put out death threats on them, and that's two dragons that will be then out of her field. Like, potentially, if she were to send like her like Ulf and those guys after the princesses, then that could end badly. Like, how is Daemon gonna react if she goes like full blood and fire and vengeance because her son was killed because of the girl? Then what's Daemon gonna do, because they're his kids?
I can see them, you know, maybe adapting a bit more of Nettle's storyline by having Rhaenyra be mad at Bela and Rhaena and sending her to go be with Daemon. And I don't know how far they're going to go with the whole Nettles thing, but
yeah, we've already had weird.
Yeah,
I don't want more parent-child incest. That would be weird.
Yeah,
I'm drawing the line somewhere. Siblings are fine in this series, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah.
So we'll see what they do with that. I'm excited to see Damon's storyline going forward, especially, you know, what.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to spoil
it. I feel like having some Daemon character progression would be really helpful, because he did flounder a bit last season.
Yeah.
Having something happen with his daughters could be a very compelling way of getting him moving, other than having a drug/witch/ Werewood induced vision quest for a chunk of a season.
On rewatch, that didn't drag out as long as it did first time around.
Okay.
That's good to hear.
But still, I'd like to see some progression. Yeah.
I think
there will be.
I think his daughter's vulnerable is a really good, simple plot progression.
And I imagine, I don't know if this is the season where Aemond and Daemon take each other out.
I think, I'm hoping that's the finale, but with the way they're changed the episode structure, I have no idea at this point.
Yeah. We do see a bit of Kristen Cole, who, again, on rewatch, I ended up feeling a lot more sympathetic for him.
I like the scene, him and Gwaine in the whole, and he's just so nihilistic.
Yeah.
I think we did discuss it last season that we think Cole's going to go through sort of a if nukes exist, why even bother type mentality. And I feel like that's starting to show. And obviously Gwaine has a sort of an idealism similar to Alicent before everything went awful. And I did really like the line he's got, like, we're not beasts, we're knights or something. To be honest, I don't know what happens to him as a character, but to me that sounds pretty well like a good thing to put on your gravestone. Be idealistic and nice and be a knight. That seems like death in Game of Thrones.
His is an interesting character to follow, but also because, like, even from the beginning, right, he was pressured into sex with Rhaenyra, despite the fact that he didn't really probably want it because he was more attached to the title, and that was like the best thing that was ever going to happen to him. And then he got pressured into it by Alicent, and now he's got.
I feel like there was less pressure on Alicent's side.
Well, this is one of the situations. How can you know it's consensual? Like when you got to do whatever they ask, you know. But it felt like he was passed around a little bit, and then he was sent off to war with that stupid haircut. Like he just seems to get every short straw that there is, and I think he's just come to realize that he comes from a commoner background. And I think he's coming to realize that the games of the aristocracy they just hurt everyone. It's just hell.
Yeah. I think he's a slow learner in the Game of Thrones. Again, where is consent when the person into pushing for the relationship has dragons, has power? Equally, where is the consent when, Romeo was, 15? It's a messy situationship. It's a messy triangle of awkwardness.
Yeah, but Cole comes out the victim of it, and I in my calculation. Yeah. And
yeah.
So I get why he's odd.
I mean, Alicent, I'd say, is probably not out of the particular three-way situationship we're talking about, but in general, Alicent, I think, has pretty much the worst record for relationships.
Yeah.
She's
going to the fact that the screenshot is still her going, what the fuck, this is my son.
We've moved on to Gwaine now.
Is that still what you're seeing?
Oh, hang on a minute, is my thing stopped? Is my thing...
I've seen
oh, well, okay, mine's updating now.
It's like we'll all be beasts before that. We'll all be doom and ruin surround us. We'll all be beasts before time is up. It's a bit like the Jorah Mormont quote. There's a beast within every man, and when you put a sword in his hand, it stirs, or something like that.
It's similar vibes. I feel like Cole is progressing towards that more cynical bite. Which is interesting to then pair him with Gwaine. It's a good dynamic that I want to see slightly more of, and I'll be interested to see, like, because early Cole has been very binary and a lot of his thought processes, a lot of his actions have been very, it's either this way or the other way, there's no in between. The fact that Gawain is now saying, like, you as Knight Commander have to take action, you're the one who has to, you know, stand up for this victim of assault. And the fact that he's, you know, very cynical about it. I'll be interested to see what active action he chooses and how he reacts to it, and whether or not it's a, if he can maintain his current apathy, or whether or not at the point where he's making an action, it makes things so much worse. And kind of a similar to, like, Theon taking actions, like, pretending to kill the boys.
Yeah.
In order to prove himself to himself, and that just makes it all worse.
Yeah.
I'll be interested whether or not him feeling pressured to take a direct action against his men because of Gawain means that he... What the consequence... Like, this is the thing I love about Game of Thrones in general, is there's always consequences no matter what choice he makes. If he decides to not take action and punish this knight, then the apathy wins, and potentially that is a bad thing for the small folks. It feels like he's losing some more of his white cloak. And if he does take action, what does that do to his men? It's good. It's meaty. I enjoy it.
Yeah. Like Poet Cole, is one I'm kind of interested in. I have been told what his demise is, but I cannot remember it.
Again, I don't mind when spoilers pop up, but I'm not seeking them.
Yeah, yeah. Have we covered this episode?
I've got a couple of ones that we haven't quite covered.
Oh, yeah.
The whole Clubfoot and Aegon scene.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's great.
Which, like, I'm interested to see what Lionel's whole play was with that, because obviously he switched from being like, no, I swear allegiance to, I swear allegiance, and also here's the king, let's take him in. Is he just playing along in order to survive for himself, and is actually genuinely putting Aegon into a situation? Is he just frustrated that Aegon's a dumb bitch and is then just trying to save himself? Or was this his plan all along to surrender to Rhaenyra because he thinks that's what Alicent wants?
I think, first of all, he's mostly out to save his own ass. So at first it seemed like he was happy to go along with them. They were just going to, you know, take the knee and say they are for Rhaenyra or whatever and just move along, and he wasn't going to make a deal out of it. And Aegon, you know, stubbornly refused and put him in that position where he had to sell him out because, you know, they were like, you know, they were going to do a search of him and find a crown no matter what. So, you know, he might as well just mess up.
Shout.
Yeah, I think this was just fast Lara's thinking, where it's like, you know, the idea is, because, yeah, he was open, right,
just playing time.
Yeah, we'll bend the knee, we'll say the words, and we'll move on. And then, of course, Aegon fucked it all up. And he was like, look, the only way we're going to get out of here now is by coming clean that we're valuable hostages, and you don't want to kill us. That'd be bad for you. You want to keep us alive. That's profitable. There'd be a good bounty for us alive. Because the thing is with Larys as well is that Larys is probably not important enough that he'll be kept alive on his own. Like, he is an accessory to all of this. And by all accounts, especially from the perspective of these soldiers, a minor accessory. People might not even know who he is. It's like whether or not people wouldn't, you know who, for example, a member of a cabinet administration might be, you know, like,
yeah. And I can't remember, so this is a genuine question, what does Rhaenyra think of Lionel? Because obviously she loves his brother.
Oh, Lionel.
Larys, sorry. Larys. So she loved his brother, so he's the uncle to her bastards. Does she know that he was responsible for the death of his brother and father? Does she suspect it?
I'm trying to think
whether or not they've ever had a discussion on it, whether or not she has ever interacted with him, because obviously he's been primarily focused on Alicent, so he's been on her side of the coin. But like, could he go to Rhaemyra and be like, "Hi, I'm the father of your children"? Like, has he played that card? Does she suspect it? I genuinely can't remember if we've had any thought on how she reacts to him as a character.
My initial gut reaction would be he has deliberately avoided Rhaenyra to play Team Green. And the reason he's avoided her is because if Team Green loses, it's then more subtle to shift sides.
Yeah. He can claim kind of impartiality.
Yes, exactly. That's
yeah.
It, right? That's just my dark. And yeah, he could also sort of make up a bit of history. Options. Yeah. If he's openly plotting against Rhaenyra, you know, because he doesn't have people to save his ass. He has to, he's like, you know, he has got to cling to powerful people and be valuable to powerful
people.
He's
a self-made man.
He's got to walk in the shadow of other people, because no one will save him. No one will go out of their way to save him. He's not a king. He's not hugely important. He's just a wealthy guy that. Oh, hang on a minute. He did own.
He's the heir to the Baratheons, isn't he?
No.
He's a strong.
You're
thinking of Lionel Baratheon from A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yes, my brain, the Strongs were a more powerful family and more connected with the Baratheons than they are, but they're actually a lower household, aren't they? Sorry.
Yeah, well, and I think he's the last of his house now, technically.
Yeah, I was going to say he's the last of his house, so he should have some stuff.
There's this thingy in Harrenhal. What's his name?
Who?
The Harrenhal Strong, his cousin or something like that.
I don't remember.
We all really liked him.
I need to rewatch so much of this.
What's his name? Chat, can you help me out? He was a strong. He was in Harrenhal.
Was he the old guy or the kid?
Yeah, the old guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
Very vague memory.
I do remember now. Yeah.
So it's not Harwin. Otto. No. Where is he? Dance of Dragons, Lords of Harrenhal. He wasn't really a Lord of Harrenhal. He was just the Keeper of Harrenhal, or the Castellan of Harrenhal, or something like that.
I would need to look it up. Whether or not he's got land and holdings to hold back on if he needs to become, you know, if he needs to claim that. I genuinely can't remember. But yeah, it's just, I was just interested to see which of the many cards in his deck he was playing during that sequence. Because I just found it, it could have been pure exasperation. He's like, well, if you're not smart enough, kid, to lie when the time comes, then I'm not going to back you up, my dude. But also, I find it interesting because obviously Aemond hasn't directly sworn fealty to Rhaemyra, so technically he's not actually abdicated. I think it was very important that he never actually said, "I swear loyalty to Rhaemyra," even in, even in, to save his life as a lie or a deception. The fact that he hasn't technically abdicated from the crown, is a useful tool to have in the box for later.
I actually found a decent amount of on-screen chemistry between Larys and Aegon. Actually, I thought, like, as a Game of Thrones double act, I think they could be quite good.
I think
they're both phenomenal actors, especially they both got Aegon.
The bastards and broken things like Mantra are both broken things. I enjoy the fact that Larys is also trying to sober him off Milk of the Poppy.
He's
doing like false rehab, so it's a useful thing to have as a system. I'm enjoying the fact that even though this bounced around so much and still managed to have a big epic battle sequence, there's still so many little things that are being set up that have strings that can be pulled later. It's very good depth of storytelling. I do enjoy, you know, having a sprawling Game of Thrones series, as much as I enjoy the simplicity of Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, and that's more enjoyable to watch. I'm excited to watch because it's more light. When you have this show, you're like, oh, but what if they pulled this string? What if this means this?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got a couple of super quick ones.
Absolutely.
The references to Red Priest and King's Blood or Fluid, that one came back. That's kind of a flash forward and flashback. I don't know if it'll come up in this series about Red Priests and using King's Blood, but that's definitely a well-established through line within the lore of this show. Helena, knowing that she's actively scared Aemond, that she's aware that he's acting out of fear, is really interesting, because I think he's a character that's so driven by fear. He's, you know, who's scared of being bullied, he was scared of being neglected, he was scared of being treated as the boy with the pig instead of the dragon, and then he got the big dragon and forgot that he is just a scared kid underneath all, and he's still making decisions out of fear continuously. And so the fact that Helena is so far the only character that feels genuinely capable of threatening him, and I think it's because, like, the end of the last season, he did a whole thing where he's like, oh, I could throw you from this, I could have you killed, this is slander or whatever, and she's like, yeah, do it, like, she doesn't fear him. And so I think she, it's, again, if we're talking gender dynamics, she, for all intents and purposes, is in the same sort of place as Alicent regarding patriarchy as it stands.
Yeah,
she can sidestep a lot of social convention, which Alicent can't, and that I think gives her such a interesting sidestep.
Yeah, she's a royal family side character.
Everyone thought it was cute that Sheep Stealer brought food.
Oh yeah,
and shared the dinner. They, so to perfection.
It's like Mama Bird.
Yeah, char grilled for your enjoyment.
Yeah, where is that? I can't find
with
that.
A little bit of extra seasoning from stomach acid.
Oh god.
I imagine it's like a peppery taste. And my last one was the Elizabeth First reference.
Yeah.
And a little bit not only broad but also not quite appropriately used. I don't feel like it was quite relevant for the context of the scene. I feel like there's places where that particular quote and the meaning of that particular quote would hold a lot of weight for Rhaenyra, but in
British
this
thing
particular case,
because I didn't notice.
It's like, I may have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a concrete elephant.
Yeah. So it's famously. You might have heard it through cultural osmosis more than actual teaching, but basically there's famously a speech that Elizabeth I made to the troops during the beginning of the Spanish Armada, I believe, where she went and met the troops, and she wore a breastplate on top of her clothing, and she made this speech about, even though that she is just a pathetic woman, she is still a king, or she has the it's
heart
one
and
of the
stomach
most
of a concrete elephant.
Yes. And there's various questions on how accurate that description of the speech is, and how close she was to the battlefield, and how much she was talking to her actual soldiers versus talking to the generals. And there's a lot of like minutia within the historic reckoning of it. But it's considered to be this moment of powerful girl power with genuine precedence, like with genuine like weight behind the sentiment, like not just girl power in sort of a, you know, 90s pop star way, but like a queen standing before soldiers and then leading them forward into successful battle. And again, historical precedent in terms of like how relevant it actually was and how close she was to the battlefield aside, it's one of the most famous quotes from a reigning monarch. I can't really think of too many other like immediately quotable speeches on record from monarchs. Like obviously Anne Boleyn's final letter and final words are one of the ones that, you know, those are powerful to me. But I can't. I mean, Chris, can you think of any quotes from kings or queens? I think apart from one is not amused.
Oh yeah. Well, there's probably a King George quote that I'm missing. I'm not super well versed on this kind of thing.
I'd say like the that particular line is up there for, if not the most well-known, one of the most...
Not an actual quote, but my horse, my kingdom for a horse, Richard III.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that reinvented Shakespeare. By Shakespeare? Yes.
That's Shakespeare. Yeah. And then like the similar one, which would have been for God, country, and...
Rumpy Pumpy.
Whatever. those sort of things. What's more into the breach, those sort of things, which like... Whether or not they're actually on record as ever being said by monarchs or just Shakespeare having fun.
Who said now is the summer of discontent? Or now is the winter of our discontent, sorry.
Ooh.
That was...
Want to say one of the Henrys?
Richard III. No, wait, spoken by the character Richard, Duke of Gloucester. Not a king.
But yeah. Again, heavily associated with... But again, I can't think of any other quotes from... Royal specifically.
Friends, Romans, countrymen's not a king though. That was that Julius Caesar or something?
Is that Julius Caesar?
Yeah. But then again, that's Shakespeare, you know.
Shakespeare's interpretation.
Yeah.
And obviously Elizabeth wouldn't have been interpreted by Shakespeare in that way because
Mark Antony.
I was gonna say, was it Mark Antony or Julius Caesar? And is that in Antony and Cleopatra?
That is in Act Two of Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar.
Okay. Cool. But yeah, I'd say it's one of the most iconic historical quotes that I can think of, and the only one that I can think of on a reigning monarch. And the way that it was presented in this, I'll be interested again, Max, as someone who didn't know it was a reference. How did you feel about that delivery?
You know, I mean, I feel like you said, I feel like I've heard something similar through cultural osmosis, so. I don't know. Nothing bothered me about the delivery or anything. I thought, you know, I'm like, well, it seemed like a pretty natural line for her to say, for me, okay. From someone who doesn't like have a lot of meaning, built up in it.
I mean, that's good because for me, it took me way out of it. It took me so out of it. I was like, what a weird way to say that thought. And like, I feel like there would be different summations of the sentiment without it being so close to the original wording. And so it took me so far out of it.
I can see that for you and other people that
I don't think it took me out of it. Like I knew the reference. I did that Leonardo DiCaprio meme where he points at the telly. Like I did that. Like yeah. I know that one. But Game of Thrones has always riffed off historical stuff, hasn't it? So I found that relatively typical of the show. I think it's not.
Yeah, if she quoted like Abraham Lincoln or something, like a house divided will not stand. I mean, that would throw me out of it. I'm like what? I'm like that doesn't add up. But yeah. I don't know, something about the whole British royal thing, it's like it seems to go.
I don't know, if I heard a house divided will not stand, that would blend in with me, I reckon.
Yeah, okay. Because we wouldn't know the reference. It's interesting to me. So I have just looked up the quote. So the quote itself, as per what is written record, is, "I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too." And so it was, I feel like, for me, it took me out of it because it was just too close to the sentiment.
Mm.
And I feel like there would have been ways of wording it that wouldn't have been so specific. But again, as you said, like the references to real history are very prolific throughout Game of Thrones in general. So it's fine in theory, but like the concept of the War of the Roses or having like historical kind of secret siblings within the characters versus real history, I'm fine with. But that it felt too much of a direct quote. It felt really strange to me.
Mm.
But again, it's not. It was a beautiful scene, and it was wonderfully acted. And like her, was she cutting up? I couldn't quite work out what she was stabbing at.
Oh, her riding leathers.
Was her riding leathers? Because I thought she'd changed into her riding leathers already.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what she was stabbing at too. I wasn't really.
Yeah, it made sense for it to be her riding leathers, but also that's a waste of good fabric.
Yeah, especially back then. Where is she?
And like, this is custom riding leathers of a Targaryen queen during a war. Like, you don't want to mess with your leathers.
Was she in her? No, she's not in her riding leathers. I don't think that's not riding leathers.
Okay, so it must be her riding leathers that she's cutting up, which is like take out your frustration at the door.
Yeah.
And also, like, the other thing that this is like a bizarre little side thought that I had is obviously in the last season, she was attacked in her chambers. I can't remember. So is there just one entrance to her chambers? Because in my head, if I was of a royal personage during a war and someone managed to attack me in my bedchambers, I would potentially find, like, set myself up like a fire escape.
I you
know, tell maybe one person.
It's another vector of attack, potentially.
My interpretation is that there's like a suite. So she's got the bedchambers and then she's probably got like a living quarters further out. Probably with a single, entrance.
Well, there must be, or else she would have gone out a different exit rather than, beating at the door and getting pissed off.
Yeah,
it's totally, totally, totally viable. I would also be pretty ticked off if my offspring decided to lock me in my bedroom
and then die. Like, I feel the two things
and then die
compound.
Ooh, yeah, I would be pretty ticked off with them if they went off and died.
Because you'd feel all your worst fears were vindicated. If you come back alive, she'd be like, look, I'm dead pissed with you, son, but fine, all right, no harm done. But this is lots of harm done. I've lost another son. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to... I'm excited for this season. Mm,
it's good. I enjoyed this episode, and I'm looking forward to next week. And hopefully we'll get our shifts in alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Were you working today, Max?
I was able to take a half day today. I actually had other stuff, other errands I had to do today, so it worked out.
Oh, good.
Okay. Yeah, for the summer, I usually am able to work like 9-hour days, 4 days a week, and then I do a half day one of the days. So.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Nice.
Yeah.
I usually work 4 days most weeks and days I work five tend to be shorter days. So, but it's all over the place. So I think, we'll work out when we can do it. But I think Tuesday evening might work for me next week, I think.
I don't have my rota for next week because my boss is trying my patience. So I have no idea what I'm working next week. I have literally no concept. I don't know if I'm off. I don't know what days I'm off. I don't know what days I'm on. I don't know whether or not I'm on earlys or late.
Yeah, I might be able to do Tuesday around this time, but we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm on early, then this time is fine. If I'm on days off, that's fine. And if I'm on late shifts, then not fine. But nice.
And also your D&D on Wednesday.
My D&D on Wednesday. Which was cancelled this week.
Oh, is that in-person D&D?
Yes, it is. The guild that I'm part of, we started off in the back of a pub with I think three tables, and then we expanded it back out into the pub, got an extension and got like a wedding venue slash rentable space. And so we expanded from those three tables into the exhibition space as well. And then we still got too big for that. So we went to a community center, which had two rooms, and then we got too big for that. And so we expanded out into a different community center with three full size, like.
How many people are part of this campaign? Is this a massive campaign or something?
But this isn't a campaign. So the guild itself is, the way it's structured is you get to vote. So a block is 3 months and you get to vote for which game you want to play in. So the DMs, anyone who wants to run a game, pitches a little like paragraph on what the story is going to be, what system they're using. So it doesn't necessarily have to be in D&D. How many players they want to have, any like age stats type thing. So like whether or not it's going to be like violent or gory or, scales of innuendo, whether or not it'll be PG-13 and appropriate for people who want a more kind of low key combat like scenario, whether or not it's going to be like exploration or combat or just pure RP. And they do a little paragraph and then you can vote for which game you want to play in. And then you join that table. So you can be in long running campaigns. You just vote to continue the game that you're in. So I've been in this campaign for, I think this is the third block of a new campaign. And my last campaign went for, I think 15 blocks. It was a long campaign. It was like 3 years.
Oh, wow.
It was really good. I really, really liked it. And so the whole guild, I think we have over like 120 members total now. And we do Wednesdays and Thursdays. So there's we got a different location for Thursdays. We had to expand. There was enough room in the community center for everyone who wanted to play. So they decided to open up a second day in the week that they run games. And that's run on Thursdays, which I've never been able to attend because I beg, borrow, stole and pleaded for my Wednesday evenings.
Oh, wow. That's pretty popular. I always find it difficult to find, you know, good people to play with. Because people get a bit, you know.
So lucky. Yeah. And the good thing about the guild structure is if a table isn't your cup of tea, then when after 3 months, you can just vote into a different game. And it's a no fault system.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find a group that you really like with the DM you really like, you just can continue to vote if they continue to pitch. And they could also, you know, the DM could get burned out. They could say, I'm not able to run next session for like next block for personal reasons. So then you can join a different game. And there's like some tables that do like DM practice groups. So for their pitch, they'll be like, hi, three different DMs who want to learn how to run games. We'll all be doing one game a week or one game a month just to see how we do. You know, new players welcome. And so it's such a lovely, I lucked out so much. I literally sent an email to the guild lead in 2015 or 16. Be like, hi, I watch Critical Role and it seems like a lot of fun. And I've played a little bit of tabletop RPGs, but would it be okay if I came along? And she messaged back and was like, yeah, sure. I'll let one of the DMs know you're going to join their table. And I will say that first session was awful. I spent the entire time.
I feel like most first sessions are not the best. You got to get in the swing of things. Well,
it was a bit more casual and a bit less structured when I first started in the guild. So I joined a pre-existing campaign for like two sessions. And so it was a well-established, experienced group. And the DM was running a very rules as written hard campaign, so the entire of the session he was like, okay, you're new, read through the book, write your character sheet, and then jump in when you're ready and we'll like find a way to integrate you into it. And I had no idea what I was doing, and it's quite a lot of information. I was kind of panicking, and so I spent a huge amount of time flicking through the book trying to work out how to write a character sheet, because he was busy being distracted looking after his group. I say looking after because it was a very hard campaign. And while I was trying to build my character sheet, the entire party was TPK'd, except for the druid, who hid in a sarcophagus while being hunted by an undead like bugbear or something, and attempted to take an 8-hour rest so they could get their spells back. The rest of the party, who were all dead. And then I think the second session, one of the other DMs from another table was like, hey, I want to run a beginner's game. So if you want to join the beginner's game. And I was like, yes, please. We'll join the beginners. But then after that, I've been really, really lucky, actually. I've only actually had one DM that just their style wasn't to my liking. And so it wasn't a successful campaign. And another DM who, not through really a fault of their own, but I completely misunderstood the system. It wasn't D&D, it was a mage system.
Oh, yeah.
And so I misunderstood when building my character, how my character would function. And so then I had to significantly adjust my characterization in order to accommodate for the way that the system worked its magic system. It was an interesting campaign.
Yeah.
And I've been with the same DM now for 4 years. He's a really good guy, and it's a really lovely group that I'm with.
I've played a D&D-ish style game that if you guys game much would quite enjoy. It's called Esoteric Ebb. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I feel like I've heard of it, but I haven't actively engaged with it.
It's an amazing concept. It's got like your D20 dice rolls and your strength, constitution, dexterity, knowledge, wisdom, charisma. I think that's all of them. But they It is a role playing game where you go out and you discover the world. But all of those characteristics are like they're like parts of you, and parts of your personality. And you put points into like you know wisdom or you know all your intellect or your charisma or your strength or whatever, and those parts of your personality become more dominant in like the conversations that you have, and the skill checks that you do, and it branches out loads. And it is set in.
I mean that sounds pretty D&D-ish, but
yeah,
I think the impression that you're getting is that you're like your stats. Derive more of your characterization than yes. sometimes can be applied to D&D. So D&D, sometimes those stats are ways of enforcing decisions that you've already made, while your version is more these stats make the decisions for you, and then you kind of flow from there. That makes sense?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, you still get choices and you still get dialogue options. It's the world itself is a little bit like... Have you seen the Dungeons & Dragons film, the recent one with Chris Pine? Yep. Love that film. I think I give it a 10 out of 10 on my website or something like that, because it's exactly what you want it to be. But it's kind of like that sort of medieval fantasy universe that isn't too serious, which is quite nice. It's not too grisly. They have bikes in it. It's weird, but fuck it. Why not?
Well, that's one of the things I like about the pitching system as well with the guild that I'm part of is if you're in the mood for something lighthearted and fun, you can just join a game that the DM describes as lighthearted and fun. So we've just, the long campaign I've just finished was a Vikings campaign, and it was pretty grimdark. There was some humor scattered around, like a couple of characters were a bit sillier. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, it was like, you know, Vikings at war, Ragnarok's coming, there's, you know, evil things to do. My character was one of my most traumatized characters I've ever played. I tend to try and do like well-adjusted, traumatized, just to spice things up. And it was like quite a dark campaign, and there was some pretty grim stuff in it. And now we're doing a Dolmingwood campaign, which is very like whimsy forest vibes. Like there are talking mushroom people, and there's a lot of like fairy stuff, and there's like spooky witchy stuff, and like it's such a different vibe. And now I'm playing a very sexually liberated knight. She chastity was not part of her vows, therefore she does not bye bye them. And she's very fun to play. She's such a dichotomy to my last character, who was very shut down and virginal and traumatized, and to play a very liberated person on the other side is very funny to me. It was quite like the whiplash the other people at table got, because some of them hadn't played with me before I played my very shut down, very traumatized, very butter wouldn't melt character. And then we started the next campaign, I was straight in with this character who is a delightful deviant, and very outgoing and very sociable, in comparison to a character who never really, you know, spoke more than 20 sentences. It's very fun. It's one of the reasons I love role playing. I do have Junior Dax was saying they haven't played in so long because there's no one local, and kind of saying that scheduling is the biggest foe. I'm delighted to announce that a couple of my younger colleagues have keep on coming up to me and be like, "Hi Jenny, I'm gonna start playing D&D," and I'm like, "Yes, you do that." They're like, "But scheduling is so hard." I'm like, "Yeah." One of them had one session and then came up to me like 2 days later, was like, "We had our first session, it was amazing, but we've already got into social drama and people aren't getting along, and it looks like we're not going to carry on with the campaign.
Oh no,
I'm gonna find someone else." And I'm just like, this is so, it's such a like welcome to the party cliche that brings me joy, because it's probably the most universal experience of playing D&D as adults. It isn't the dragons, it isn't the system, it isn't the people, it's the fact that getting people to the table is the biggest challenge.
It is It's like that with anything though, isn't it? Board games or podcasting. I mean, we do a good job because all three of us are pretty good at that kind of thing. But it's still, sometimes we still have to fit ourselves. Schedules. Yeah, we still have to find the spot for it. It's,
yeah. I did have to tell my boss no. My boss was trying to swap chips with me because he'd missed something in his life. So he was like, "Oh, Jenny, can you swap? And I'll do your early, and I'll do if you do my late." I was like, "I have plans with my friend." I didn't say I was doing a game, House of the Dragon podcast, but I was like, "No, I have friends' plans."
It's valid.
Yeah, it counts as friends' plans.
Yeah. And then he asked my other colleague, who was like, "No, I'm spending time with my fiance. Is it the only 2 days, the only day that we both have shifts matching?" And then he asked my third colleague, and she was like, "Yeah, okay." So he did manage to get his shift swap in the end. So if you were worried about my boss being contented,
I was going to be devastated if he didn't
It's generally like for that kind of thing, not too bad for me because Rosie is she works from home, so when I get I quite like working weekends in a lot of cases because it's just a bit more chill. You don't get rush hours and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So when I get days off that are in the week, we still kind of get to hang out. We're still around each other a fair bit, so it's not too.
That's nice.
And sometimes we could do lunch together if I'm taking a layover break in nearby.
Nice. How are you finding your work? Are you enjoying it still? You sound quite excited.
Yeah, it's really good. It's got its challenges, but it's the heat, really. But
what temperature are you right now? Because according to the internet, it is still 29 degrees outside right now.
I reckon it's about where I am right now in this room is probably about 24-25, but further in the house where the air conditioning is, it's going to be probably close to 20, which is nice.
You have indoor air conditioning. That's amazing. I think I'm pretty sure the temperature inside is the same temperature as outside, maybe slightly cooler. So I think I've left the thermometer in the sitting room, but I'll check it and message you after the stream is over to be like, indoors, the temperature is, but it's definitely in the late 20s at minimum.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, I mean, Rosie got it before she even met me, and she works from home, it's super essential for her in that regard. But as a bus driver as well, like, when it's so hot that it keeps you up, and having indoor air conditioning so that you get a good night's sleep, that's so, like, important. You know, you can't be driving a bus if you're just not sleeping well. It's just... Then it becomes an issue of public safety. So I'm very, very grateful that we do have it.
I'm quite lucky that my house setup does mean that it cools pretty well at night. So I haven't had that much disturbed sleep, which I think is definitely more than a lot of my colleagues. A lot of my colleagues have been coming into work recently, and I wouldn't want to know them. I have been lucky in that front, but it is still pretty, pretty warm.
Sorry, Canet. What's Fahrenheit? What's 80 in Fahrenheit numbers? Hang on a minute. Let me get a translator up.
One sec. What temperature? So you're saying 26. Your room is 70. Okay.
80 is
26.
Yeah.
80 is 26. So right now, let's see. What does the internet tell me? I am in Fahrenheit. I want to say I'm in late 80s. Fahrenheit. Okay.
I just had to take a call for a second. I'm back. Were you talking about Fahrenheit? I love Fahrenheit.
Do you love Fahrenheit?
I'm 84.
I like both. I like, I think they both serve their purpose. Fahrenheit. So
the thing I Kelvin. Finally clocked about Fahrenheit, which actually means most of the time I can get it more or less right. Which I think totally makes sense. And like all this time I've been like, Fahrenheit doesn't make any sense. Okay. It doesn't make sense. Why would it be calculated to what it is? I realize the reason why it's calculated where it is. So obviously Celsius is 0 is frozen or freezing or about to freeze, and 100 is boiling.
Yep.
That makes sense to me logically.
At sea level simple. On Earth.
Fahrenheit, 100 is body temperature. It's 37.5 or whatever.
Oh.
And it totally makes sense.
98.6
is like just about on par with human core body temperature. So that totally makes sense why that is essential information to learn, is that the height, the 100, the what you would guys would like call a flat, nice round number, is what's medically relevant. Like if someone says they have a fever of 104, I know that means that you are above natural standard core body temperature. If you're telling me that you are hypothermic at 83, I'm like, bloody hell, get that person a blanket. Like that makes sense. 83
might be dead. I don't. Yeah, that's like
83 might be like you know, they're in some sort of case of what's the word? They're getting stiff from being dead. What's the word?
Hypothermia.
Rigor mortis. Getting rigor mortis.
Rigor mortis.
But at the moment, according to the internet right now, it is 84 degrees Fahrenheit in my home.
What's the temperature tomorrow? I gotta work that out. I gotta
drive in tomorrow. Your home, it's 85 in your house?
In my house, right now.
Okay, because I don't set the thermostat below like 76 in the summertime, so... Or above 30.
I have no temperature control. There is the only thing I can do to my house is make it hotter. So I could turn on the boiler and turn on the heating. I'd have to turn it up pretty high.
Well, it's a bit cooler
but
tomorrow.
I have no means of making it cooler. Apparently tomorrow's, I think, in Oxford's due to be similar. Well, in fact, they've extended the red weather warning in Oxford. So originally they said it was going to break 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Now it's going to be like 12 p.m. tomorrow night, which is inconvenient because I'm running an event for 200 people in an un-air-conditioned room with hot plates. And so it's going to be very hot.
Oh, I could go for a swim in that ocean right now.
I mean, I think once we're done with this podcast, I might go back into the sitting room and put my feet in a bucket of ice water. That's the dream.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I think we should probably wrap it up. Actually, I got a 5 o'clock start tomorrow.
Oh, bless you.
Well, I mean, at least it's not getting up in the heat.
Yes. Yeah. And at least you've got air conditioning, so you get a good night's sleep.
I get a good night's sleep. There's no air conditioning on the fucking bus, though.
That's crazy to me. That's crazy. That would not happen in America.
They got them on the new electric buses, but we don't get anywhere near those, being country drivers. In the city routes,
it's 50% of the buses to Oxford. I can't remember if it's the Oxford Bus Company or Stagecoach. One of the two has aircon, the other one does not. And like I think it's the Oxford City Bus Company has like aircon and also like wireless charging points and a bunch of other stuff, and then Stagecoach, nah. But all the other way around, I can't remember.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I know that the buses I see around from a bunch of the companies around here, they're starting to roll out the new Yutongs, the electric buses, which look mighty fancy. I've not been trained on an electric bus yet, so I can't drive them.
Oh, so what's it? Do you, is the bus do you drive manual then?
No, it's an automatic gearbox. They've been automatic for like 20 years, I think. Thank God. Power steering as well.
I've only ever driven one vehicle without power steering, and I would not wish it on my worst enemy.
Well, the first car I drove after I passed my test was my mum's VW Polo, which was like one of the old ones, the boxy ones. And it was really fun to drive. That didn't have power steering, but it was a really small car, so it wasn't like too bad. And it actually, there was actually,
so the only vehicle I've ever driven without power steering was the electrical ice cream van. This is a plug-in electrical little like quite heavy van because it had freezers in it, and it was a automatic, not automatic, it was automatic. It only had two gears. It did not have power steering, and it was heavy, and the sheer amount of force required to turn that wheel and get it to turn was insane.
Was it supposed to have power steering, or is it an old milk?
No, I think they were trying to save money, and so they'd retrofitted a older vehicle to have electric source for power.
I mean, there are very, very old ice cream vans that are electric. Electric ice cream van. No, sorry, not electric ice cream vans. I'm talking about milk floats.
Yeah, so I think it might have been like a converted milk float or something. It was a very weird vehicle, and I'm very glad that we no longer have. But I don't like driving automatics. I feel very out of control.
Oh, interesting. Because we got two cars. One's a shitty old hairdresser car that I take to work, because when you park it in a bus depot, it gets all dusty and gritty and stuff. You don't want to put a nice car there. The other car we got is electric, and all electrics are automatic, because that's kind of how electrics work. And I got to be honest, I don't think I could ever go back to a non-electric car. They drive so nice. They're like so nice to drive.
My sister's got an electric car. I'm very jealous.
Yeah, that's so. And it's got cooled seats.
I'm just thinking, well,
it's got heated seats and cooling seats.
Nice.
My sister's got that.
I have that in my car.
I feel like I don't want to do it today because I've closed the tab. But what we have to try and remember to do next, is do what we did for Knight of Seven Kingdoms and see whether or not my version of the video has more or less visual content than your guys'.
The time code comparison.
The time code comparison.
I was wondering thinking about that again. The version I have is straight from the YouTube version of HBO. So I didn't have like a previously on or anything at the beginning of my
version. Neither did I, which
really, was hoping for that. And I think the regular broadcast version got that, but for some reason, the one they posted on YouTube, HBO Max.
Yeah, I feel like I could have done with a recap as well. I don't think mine came with a recap either. Let me see how long mine one was.
All right.
We weren't going to do it. And here I am.
1 hour, 5 minutes, 37 seconds.
Yeah, like last time, Chris, you and mine are the same exact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me see. I've got to load up the correct episode. Sorry. I was like, I'm not going to do this. And then here I am doing it. Okay. So let me actually click on the episode. So mine is 1 hour, 7 minutes and 3 seconds.
Did you have a recap?
A bit longer.
I've got a load for adverts one moment. I don't think I did. I don't think I did have recaps, but I've got to wait for 31 seconds worth of adverts. So you know what? I will get back to you and we can do it next time.
Cool.
We'll do it. We'll do a time cut comparison. Yeah.
Excellent. Cool.
So you guys can get on with your days.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. So, just to wrap up, thank you,
guys, folks, for hanging out in chat, by the way.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out in chat. I liked doing it live, actually. That's that kind of is nice. So if you go, I don't know. It seems nice to have a couple of folks weigh in as well. So thank you very much for joining us. Your company was exquisite. We'll see you all next week, folks.
At some point,
yeah. I'd also, by the way, just as a side note, I don't know. I still haven't fully decided on what to do for like visuals on the stream. Like at the moment, I got like mostly stills from the show. I don't know if they're going to ding me for content ID/copyright on that. So we'll see how that goes. But I don't know. Oh, maybe we could have the family tree up or. General whatever random Fahrenheit Celsius web page we're talking about. I don't know. Well, I'll work something out. It's a work in progress, but yeah, okay. Thank you folks for joining me. Jenny, Max, me, Chris, was it Catnip and Junior Dax and someone else in the chat? toodaloo.
See you.
Bye.